The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power, by Robert A. Caro, Part 2, continued on cassette number 7, side 1. And businessmen who did not support Avery would support Brownlee or Harris, familiar, trusted faces. They would not support Lyndon Johnson. Indeed, documentation for these pessimistic conclusions had been provided that very day by the district's leading newspaper, the Austin Statesman. The Statesman had named possible candidates to succeed Buchanan in a list that included not only the favorites, but long shots as well. The name of Lyndon Johnson had not even been mentioned. Of all the men influential in 10th District politics, Lyndon Johnson was close to only one. Reaching Austin at the end of his 166-mile drive, he turned not toward his home but onto Congress Avenue and pulled up in front of the Littlefield building. The floor to which he went was not the 6th, where his own offices were located, but the 7th, on which Alvin Wirtz worked. And there he asked Wirtz for his support. Like two other older men who had hitherto played large roles in Johnson's adult life, Cecil Evans and Sam Rayburn, Alvin Wirtz had no son of his own. Perceptive observers in Washington would find this similarity significant when, later, they saw the young man and the older one together. Lyndon would always call him Yes, Sir, and No, Sir, Virginia Durr says. It was the junior to the senior, you see. Lyndon had these relationships with older men like Alvin and Sam Rayburn. They both sort of treated him like a son. And in Austin, Wirtz's secretary, Mary Rather, made a similar observation. She had, in fact, been astonished at her boss's behavior when, one day early in 1935, a lanky young man, just as tall as he could be and just as thin as he could be, whom she had never seen before, came dashing into Wirtz's state office with his long, fast steps. Her boss, usually so studiedly unemotional, rushed out and grabbed him and hugged him. He was tickled pink to see him. After he left, I said to Senator Wirtz, "Who was that young man?" She was to see a lot more of him. Telephoning Wirtz from Washington to inform him of his NYA appointment, Johnson asked him to find him office space, which Wirtz did in the building where he himself worked. He named Wirtz chairman of the NYA's State Advisory Board, and they consulted frequently. When Johnson entered Wirtz's reception room, Wirtz would tell Miss Rather, "Here comes my boy Lyndon." Hugging him, he would say, "Hello, Lyndon, my boy." After Johnson emerged from Wirtz's private office and went back to his own, Senator would come out, puffing on a cigar, and tell her how quickly Johnson had caught on to a complicated engineering problem. "I just can't get over the young man grasping these things so quickly," he would say. Although Wirtz made himself available as confidant to many bright young men, his attitude toward Johnson, Miss Rather saw, was special. He was ambitious for him, and he thought he had the ability, and he loved him. Senator Wirtz had a wife and daughter. He was fond of them, but he would have loved to have had a son, and he loved him, Lyndon, like a son. Wirtz was to inscribe a picture of himself, "To Lyndon Johnson, whom I admire and love with the same affection as if he were, in fact, my own son." Nonetheless, had it not been for the dam in which Alvin Wirtz's dreams were now invested, his paternal affection for Lyndon Johnson might have found forms of expression other than support for Johnson's congressional candidacy. To a businessman politician like Wirtz, his congressman's friendship was all important. He would not ordinarily risk antagonizing the probable winner of the congressional race by backing an opponent. He would want to side with the winner, not with a candidate whose chances were as slim as Johnson's. Now, however, the dam was all important. It lay at the point of death. It would, in fact, be effectively dead if the necessary legislation was not rushed through Congress. If it was not, in fact, passed during the congressional session that had already begun, and that would adjourn within a few weeks after Buchanan's successor was sworn in. It could not be revived by Buchanan's shy, politically unsophisticated widow, and Wirtz felt it was unlikely to be revived by Buchanan's campaign manager. Friendly, C.N. Avery may have been, forceful he was not. An adjective frequently used to describe him is easygoing. In Wirtz's opinion, he was rather weak and lazy. Moreover, well-known though Avery was in the 10th District, Senator had observed on his trips to Washington, the congressmen and bureaucrats, effusive in their greetings when they passed the powerful Buchanan in the halls of the Capitol, tendered only perfunctory courtesies to his aide. says Wally Hopkins, familiar with Senator's thinking on the subject. He, Avery, didn't have the drive, and he didn't know his way to first base in Washington. Such drawbacks would not normally be decisive considerations in the selection of a Texas congressman. He could be expected to remain in Congress long enough to learn his way around all the bases and to acquire enough seniority to offset lack of drive. He would eventually be a committee chairman himself, a power like old Buck had been. Had it not been for the Marshall Ford Dam, Wirtz's support might well have gone to Avery. It would probably not have gone to Lyndon Johnson. Because of the dam, however, the normal course of events would not help Alvin Wirtz or his client Herman Brown. Slow accretion of knowledgeability and power wouldn't rescue that project. Speed, furious speed, was what was necessary. If Wirtz and Brown needed confirmation of the precariousness of their situation, it was shortly to arrive. On March 6th, 2 weeks after Buchanan died, the Bureau of Reclamation sent to the Bureau of Budget for processing a routine form concerning the dam. The Bureau promptly sent it back, marked disapproved, noting that not only had the Marshall Ford Dam never been authorized by Congress, but because of a question over title, there was substantial doubt as to whether it would ever be. The money from the initial $5 million appropriation would, Brown calculated, run out on September 1st, with the Brown and Root balance sheet for the dam still $500,000 in the red. As a result of the Budget Bureau disapproval, moreover, there was no longer any assurance that Brown and Root would receive even the balance of that initial appropriation. The Bureau of Reclamation immediately sent to the dam site a team of auditors with unusual instructions. The Bureau customarily audited a contractor's figures only at the end of the job. Henceforth, on the Marshall Ford Dam project, each bill, however insignificant, that Brown and Root submitted was to be audited as it came in, so that in the event the Budget Bureau suddenly placed a stop order on the whole project, the Bureau would not have paid the firm a cent more than was due it for work actually performed. Herman Brown was face to face with financial ruin, and both he and Wirtz were faced with the ruin of their dreams. A good old boy could never save the Marshall Ford Dam. And neither could a good young boy, a dynamic district attorney such as the 39-year-old Harris, for example, without Washington experience. Bright, aggressive, and energetic, Harris could be expected to learn his way around Washington quickly, but not quickly enough to save the dam. What the dam needed in Washington was a champion already knowledgeable enough and possessed of sufficient entree to find, swiftly, bypasses through the bureaucracy. A champion, for example, able to cut through the endless red tape at the Bureau of Reclamation by obtaining the personal interest of the Bureau's boss, Interior Secretary Ickes, or perhaps of the congressman of whom Ickes was particularly fond, Maury Maverick. What the dam needed in Washington was a champion with entree to congressmen powerful enough to roll over those bureaucratic obstacles, the Budget Bureau's quibbling over legalities, for example, that could not be bypassed. A congressman such as Sam Rayburn, for example. What the dam needed in Washington was a champion with entree to the chairman of the committee with jurisdiction over the dam, Rivers and Harbors Joseph Jefferson Mansfield, or if not to Mansfield himself, then to the man whose advice Mansfield followed slavishly, the man who pushed Mansfield's wheelchair through the halls each day at noon, Roy Miller. And because of his trips to Washington in 1935, Alvin Wirtz was aware not only that Johnson knew Washington, but that he knew, possessed entree to, these very men. The young man sitting across his desk from him now was the champion he needed. When Johnson asked for his support, he agreed at once. He also provided Johnson with a strategy that could be summed up in three words: Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Roosevelt's Supreme Court packing plan, announced just 2 weeks before, had promptly been denounced by a Texas legislature subservient to the state's reactionary moneyed interests. But when, on February 20th, Harold Ickes, addressing the legislature during a trip to Texas, had defended the president's proposal, the audience in the packed galleries had leapt to its feet wildly cheering, in a broad hint that the state's people did not agree with their representatives. Nowhere in the state was support for the president more firm than in the 10th District, whose hill country counties had been the stronghold in decades past of the People's Party, the birthplace of the Farmers' Alliance. The party's precursor was, of course, the hill country town of Lampasas, a bare 2 miles north of the district line. An Austin-American poll of the district would shortly reveal a majority of 7-1 in support of the president's plan. Johnson should support Roosevelt's proposal, Wirt said, should in fact make support of the Supreme Court plan the main plank in his platform. He should support all Roosevelt's programs. His campaign should be based on all-out 100% support for the president, for all the programs the president had instituted in the past, and for any program the president might decide to initiate in the future. Behind that strategy lay nothing but pragmatism. Wirtz was not in favor of the Supreme Court plan. He was opposed to it. He had been telling intimates that he was a constitutional lawyer and therefore not in favor of any alteration in the court's composition. In private, his phrases were more pungent. His views, not only on court packing but on the New Deal as a whole, were the views of the reactionary Roosevelt-hating businessmen of whom he was both legal representative and confidant. Pragmatically, however, the Roosevelt strategy was Johnson's best chance to win. It would offset his greatest weakness, the fact that he was unknown to the voters, by giving him an instant popular identification, Roosevelt's man. It would give him an instant leg up on several potential candidates who were anti-Roosevelt. State Senator Brownlee, for example, had voted for the legislature's condemnation of the Supreme Court plan. And it might obtain for him the support of 2 passionate New Dealers, Governor Allred and the publisher of The American and of the Austin Statesman, Charles Marsh. Most of the candidates would be pro-Roosevelt, Wirt said. Therefore, Johnson would have to be more pro-Roosevelt than they. If he could identify himself more firmly than any other candidate as the president's champion, he would obtain the support of district voters eager to show their support for the president in general and for his Supreme Court plan in particular. L.E. Jones, then clerking for Wirtz's firm, was taking dictation from Senator when Johnson rushed in on that fateful February 23rd. He remained throughout the conversation and says he recalls it vividly. And Wirtz repeated his views at Johnson's home that evening, with other persons present. They recall Wirtz saying that Johnson's only chance to win was to get an issue, and that the issue should be the court-packing plan. The discussion, Jones says, was that the court-packing plan might be a pretty lousy thing, but to hell with it, that's the way to win. Wirtz said, "Now, Lyndon, of course it's a bunch of bullshit, this plan, but if you'll flow with it, Roosevelt's friends will support you." Jones, of course, was aware that Johnson himself was less than enthusiastic about the New Deal. He never heard Johnson express a private opinion on the Supreme Court proposal, but, he says, it didn't make a rat's ass of difference to him one way or the other. The strategy was accepted in the same spirit in which it was offered. Wirtz's support carried with it cash. As attorney for the Magnolia and the Humble, he could tap their lobbying funds. Although Johnson would not, of course, announce his candidacy until after Buchanan's funeral, that very day Wirtz phoned the headquarters of the 2 oil giants and obtained the first contributions for the Johnson campaign fund. Wirtz was also delegated to obtain funds from another source. Asked whether she knew at once that her husband would run for Buchanan's seat, Lady Bird Johnson replied, "We sure did not know we were going to run. Looking at it pragmatically, we did not have any right to expect we would win. Lyndon was from the smallest of the 10 counties. He was quite young, and finances were a problem." Wirtz, in his subtle way, enlisted her enthusiasm. "He and I had a talk, and I asked if there was a chance for Lyndon to win. He was a lawyer, and he had all the reasons lined up why we couldn't win. And at the same time, he had the reasons why we might never get another chance. He said, 'Yes, there's a very real chance, and I'd be quite lacking in my duty if I didn't tell you that it's not a big chance, but there is a chance.' So I called my daddy." The importance of the call was not so much in the money raised, Wirtz himself would eventually raise far more, but in the speed with which it was made available to the campaign. Fundraising, even by Alvin Wirtz, took time, and time was a luxury this unknown candidate couldn't afford. A large sum of seed money, at least $10,000, was needed immediately to get the campaign underway. And when Lady Bird called Captain Taylor and he asked, "How much do you need?" she replied, "We need $10,000. He said, "Are you sure you can't get by on $5,000? I said, "No, we need $10,000. He said, "All right, I'll get it for you." I said, "Can you get it for us tomorrow morning?" He said, "No, I can't." My heart sank. He said, "Tomorrow's Sunday." we'd been so busy we'd completely forgotten what day of the week it was. But I'll have it for you Monday morning at 9 o'clock. With his campaign thus made viable, Johnson was able to bring to it the resource he had created with such care, the organization already in place and at work at the NYA. Kellum, who had been appointed acting director when Johnson resigned it to run, let the top NYA staffers know they could campaign for Johnson. To a man, they flocked to his banner. Bill Deason, his first follower, who had begun following his banner in San Marcos years before, was in San Antonio when he heard the news of Buchanan's death. "I didn't have to ask anyone what was going to happen," he says. "Within a few hours after his death, Lyndon called me. He didn't mention running. He didn't mention the death. He just said, 'You know what's happened?' I said, 'Yes,' and he said, 'You better come on over here.' So I got into my car and drove to Austin." The car was Deason's most precious possession, a gleaming, spotless new Chevrolet which he kept polished to a high gloss. He was particularly proud of the fact that he didn't owe any money on the car. He had saved for more than 2 years so that he could buy it free and clear. When he heard that Lyndon Johnson was running, he realized that a campaign car would be needed, one with a loudspeaker attached to its roof. He donated the car to the campaign and allowed holes to be drilled into its roof for the bolts that secured the loudspeaker. And before he donated the car, he drove it down to his hometown of Stockdale, where they knew him at the bank, and borrowed $500 on it. And when he gave Lyndon Johnson his car, he gave him the $500, too. Some drove from farther away than San Antonio. Little Gene Latimer was at his desk in the Federal Housing Administration in Washington when he heard that the chief might run. "I called him long distance to ask if he could use any help, and he told me he wished I was there." Less than 2 days later, he was. He had hung up the telephone, arranged for a leave. His supervisor, he explains, was an admirer of Mr. Johnson's. Run out to his car and left on the 1,600-mile trip to Austin. And except to fill the car with gas, he had not stopped driving until he got there. When he arrived, "I was too exhausted to do anything except pass out." Like the chief, his men were unfamiliar with the district. Unlike Avery's organization, or Mayor Miller's, or Brownlee's, or Harris's, they had no contacts, no friends. But they had the enthusiasm of the young, and faith in their leader. In part, this faith was based on experience. No matter what anyone said, we felt he had a chance, because we knew he would work harder than anyone else, Latimer says. In part, it was blind confidence. Deason says he never had a doubt in the world that Johnson would win any contest he entered. We just assumed if he went into it, he would win. A strategy, money, an organization. These would give this unknown candidate a slim chance of victory against every opponent but one. Against that one opponent, nothing could give him a chance. Nothing could offset the sentimental appeal of a vote for old Buck's widow. If Mrs. Buchanan decided to run, words told Johnson frankly, and Johnson knew he was right, she would win. And it began to look as if she was going to run. Buchanan's funeral was held on Friday, February 26th. On Saturday, the district's most prominent politicians returned to the black-draped house in Brenham to pledge the 62-year-old Mrs. Buchanan their unanimous support. Among them was Avery, who not only said he would not run if she would, but who also volunteered to serve as her campaign manager, as he had served as her husband's. Avery's sentiments were echoed by the other leading candidates, all of whom, the Austin American reported, will stay out of the race if she entered it. In this article, Johnson's name was included in a list of potential candidates. His candidacy, too, the American reported, was subject to Mrs. Buchanan's remaining out. All day Saturday, Johnson waited anxiously in his Happy Hollow Lane house, as speculation mounted that the widow would run, and then, late on Saturday night, one of Johnson's friends, who had been waiting at the America's printing plant, ran into the house with an early copy of the Sunday paper, which contained an article that seemed to confirm the speculation. Although the article's lead said only that Avery had emerged from a meeting with Mrs. Buchanan's son to promise that an announcement on her candidacy would be made on Monday, farther down in the story, near the very end, was a paragraph that indicated what the announcement was going to be. Family associates of Mrs. Buchanan said that Mrs. Buchanan has kept closely familiar with all legislative matters affecting the district. They said she is thoroughly conversant with the district's interests in Congress to carry through the unfinished portions of Congressman Buchanan's program. Lyndon Johnson's friends would never forget how his face turned white when he read that paragraph. "You could see the color just drain out of it," says one. "He went white as a sheet." Going into his bedroom with Wirtz, he conferred with him behind a closed door. But with this problem, even Wirtz couldn't help him. So Lyndon Johnson went to see a man who could, the man who was the smartest politician he had ever known. That night, Central Texas was hit by a sudden freeze. When Johnson awoke early Sunday morning, temperatures had dropped to 29 degrees in Austin, and were much lower in the hill country. Roads were sheeted with ice. But he climbed into his car and drove the 50 miles to Johnson City, alone for once, no one with him on this trip, and pulled up in front of the little white house with the gingerbread scroll work and the wisteria, and went into the shabby front parlor and asked his father's advice. Sam Johnson didn't even have to think before giving it. "Recalls Lyndon's brother?" Lyndon started saying he was thinking of waiting to see what she, Mrs. Buchanan, does, and Daddy says, "God damn it, Lyndon, you never learn anything about politics." Lyndon says, "What do you mean?" And Daddy says, "She's an old woman. She's too old for a fight. If she knows she's going to have a fight, she won't run. Announce now, before she announces. If you do, she won't run." Mrs. Buchanan's announcement was scheduled for Monday afternoon. After driving back to Austin on Sunday afternoon, Lyndon Johnson quickly called in reporters and told them that he was in the race to stay, whether or not Mrs. Buchanan entered it. When Johnson's decision appeared in the newspapers, Mrs. Buchanan's son telephoned reporters. "Mother has just reached the decision not to run." After Lyndon Johnson had left to drive back to Austin, Sam Johnson walked over to the home of Reverdy Glidden, publisher of the Johnson City Record Courier. Glidden was eating Sunday dinner with his family when Sam came to the door and shouted in, "Glidden, I want to talk to you." "That was Mr. Sam's old booming voice," Stella Glidden says. "Oh, I hadn't heard that voice in a long, long time." Entering, he said, "Glidden, do you know what this silly boy of mine wants to do? He wants to run for Congress against 10 seasoned politicians." And he said, "Lyndon just thinks he can conquer the clouds. How can a boy run against 10 men?" For some time, Sam went on, listing all the arguments against Lyndon running, until not only Stella, whose fried chicken Lyndon had loved better than anything in the whole wide world, but her husband was moved to come to Lyndon's defense and point out that his youthfulness was offset by his Washington experience. Steering the conversation, "I only realized later when I thought about it what he was doing," Stella says, Sam made them work out for themselves the reasons why his son should be supported. Let them convince themselves more firmly than he could have convinced them. Evidence of the success of his strategy was the headline over Glidden's editorial in the Record Courier's next issue, "Johnson for Congress." We do not wish to praise Mr. Johnson merely because he is a native-born citizen of Blanco County. For the past 8 or 10 years, the home folks have seen but little of Mr. Johnson during his absence from this city because he's been a very busy man as a congressional aide and NYA administrator. What an admirable background for a young man. He's made good in all of his undertakings. He enters his political career with clean hands. No one ever heard of Lyndon Johnson doing anything that was not honorable and straightforward. Sam also introduced his son before his first campaign speech, which was delivered from the front porch of the Johnson home. Despite unpleasant memories of the native-born citizen's boyhood personality and family background, Blanco was predisposed to support him. In the rural counties of Texas, counties in which frontier privations and dangers were so fresh a memory and neighborliness therefore so prized a virtue, it was rare indeed for a county not to support its home man in a congressional race. Reinforcing this predisposition in Blanco County was the unusual depth of the county's poverty and isolation. Because its residents not only were poor but felt poor and isolated and utterly cut off from the rest of the world, the success of a Blanco boy in that world was unusually important to them. It gave them a reason for self-respect. Johnson was at the time the only local boy who they felt had made good in the outside world, the only proof that someone from our isolated corner, away up here on the Pertinalis River, could make good in that world. The little Congress sounded very impressive to them. With his election to its speakership, Johnson City at last had something to be proud of, something to take pride in. Ava Johnson Cox, Lyndon's cousin, who had so resented the way Johnson City looked down on him, recalls that when his election was reported in the Record Courier, well, that was just a boomerang. The news just went like wildfire. It went down to the barbershop, and everybody was saying, well, that old boy's going places. With his NYA appointment, they were really proud of him. Everybody was saying, that's my boy, I knew he'd do it, I knew he was coming through. Additional reinforcement was, in some cases, provided by gratitude. Ernest Morgan was not, after all, the only Hill Country youth who had been enabled to stay in college by an NYA job. More than a few Blanco families felt personally indebted to the man who had helped their children get an education. And, of course, in the 10 years since Lyndon Johnson had spent much time in Johnson City, unpleasant memories had blurred. The crowd standing in front of the Johnson home that day was more than willing to support the young man who had grown up inside. Sam turned this predisposition into something more. There was little trace of the old Sam Johnson in the man who stood before them now. The last traces of the Johnson strut had vanished as heart attack followed heart attack. The eyes that had once been so keen were dim now, and sad, and had been sad for many years. He was stooped and gray-faced. So many years had passed since he had been cut off by Johnson City merchants that his debts had long since ceased to be news. No one any longer resented a man old and ill before his time. There was even a measure of grudging respect for Sam and Rebecca's decision to move to San Marcos for 4 years so that their four younger children could finish college. As he stood before them, asking them to vote for his son, some of his listeners may even have remembered debts not owed, but owing, for pensions the old man had once arranged for them, for loans he had given them, for the highway he had gotten built. And listening to him speak, this man who once had been so great a speaker, they may have remembered also the ideals for which Honorable S. E. Johnson had stood, for he talked about President Roosevelt and Sam Rayburn, and about how, with men like them in Washington, the farmer at last had allies to fight for the causes in which farmers had so long believed, and about how his boy would help them fight, for his boy believed in the same causes. He hit the right note. In the Hill Country, in which support of Roosevelt was running 7-1, in the Hill Country which had been the birthplace and the stronghold of the Alliance Men of Texas. The causes for which Roosevelt was fighting were causes for which the Hill Country had been fighting for decades. It had, after all, been out of the Hill Country that, almost exactly half a century before, the long line of wagons bearing the blue flags of the Alliance had clattered into Austin. Sam Johnson had not made a speech for so many years, but he had never made a better speech than the one he made now for his son. Describing it, Lyndon Johnson was to say that while making it, "My father became a young man again." He looked out into all those faces that he knew so well, and then he looked at me, and I saw tears in his eyes as he told the crowd how terribly proud he was of me, and how much hope he had for his country, if only his son could be up there in the nation's capital with Roosevelt and Rayburn and all those good Democrats. There was something in his voice and in his face that day that completely captured the emotions of the crowd. When he finally sat down, they began applauding, and they kept applauding for almost 10 minutes. I looked over at my mother and saw that she, too, was clapping and smiling. It was a proud moment for the Johnson family. If it was Sam Johnson, the great speechmaker, who stirred his county into support for his son, it was Sam Johnson, the master politician, who mobilized that support. Lyndon Johnson's first major campaign rally would be Friday, March 5th, in San Marcos, in the auditorium of Old Main. Sam organized a Blanco County caravan to go to the rally. Early that Friday afternoon, Model A's and Model T's and an occasional Hudson or Packard began to pull into the square in front of the courthouse in Johnson City. So many came that the square was filled, and cars began to line the dusty streets of the little town. Most were crammed with people, whole farm families or two families riding together, and as they waited, they got out and chatted with friends. Sam had recruited young boys to put big posters bearing Lyndon's picture on each car, in the windows or tied to the radiator grill in front. And as the evening drew on, Sam and Rebecca got into his battered Model A and led the caravan out, down Route 66 for 16 miles before turning onto a bumpy, unpaved road that ran 14 miles through the hills to San Marcos. And that evening, as San Marcos students and town people began to troop toward Old Main, they heard a honking of horns from the hills above the town. And the face of Lyndon Johnson came down out of the hill country in a long, long line of rattling old cars, the longest caravan to come out of the hill country in 50 years. That rally was, however, the lone bright spot in Johnson's candidacy for some time to come. 7 other candidates had entered the election, which Governor Allred had set for April 10th. A 9th candidate entered briefly but dropped out. He would receive 12 votes in the election. A University of Texas economist, Professor Bob Montgomery, whose possible candidacy had caused Johnson much anxiety, because as a recognized New Dealer he would have drawn much of the pro-Roosevelt vote, decided at the last moment not to run. Governor Allred ruled that it would not be a party primary in which a 2-man runoff would be held if no candidate received a majority, but rather a special election, a sudden-death election in Texas parlance, in which the high man would be congressman with or without a majority. 1 candidate was a perennial also-ran, not taken seriously. 1 was a Townsendite candidate who would receive only Townsendite votes. But the others included a handsome young Austin attorney, Polk Shelton, an idealistic conservative, he, like Wirtz, identified himself as a constitutional lawyer, who had decided to run because he wanted to go to Washington and fight the Supreme Court packing plan, but who was also a former star athlete at San Marcos, well-known and popular throughout the district. And they included 4 seasoned politicians, not only longtime Williamson County Judge Sam Stone, who could expect the solid support of his county's 45,000 residents, but 3 politicians who each had a broader base. The district's state senator, Houghton Brownlee, Merton Harris, the aggressive assistant attorney general who had been working the district for years in preparation for the chance that had now presented itself, and, of course, C.N. Avery. Already the heavy favorite because of his district-wide political connections, Avery was also aided by sentimental considerations, on which he played. He was entering the race, he said in his opening statement, only because old Buck would have wanted him to. The late Mr. Buchanan told me that when he died he wanted me to run for the office he held. He told me I was the only man in the district who qualified to carry on his work. Now I feel bound to carry on his work. I feel it is an obligation to my friend. During the campaign's first week, moreover, Mayor Miller, who had decided not to run, announced that he would throw his support, and that of the Austin machine, to Avery. When Miller came out for Avery, recalls the tough, pragmatic Quill, why, we thought the race was over. Austin had the votes, you know. It was the largest city in the district. And Miller, he sure was a power and a very difficult man to oppose. It hardly seemed worthwhile to go on. Political observers were all but unanimous in conceding the election to Avery. And those few observers who thought he might be challenged thought the challenge would come from Stone, or Brownlee, or Harris. The candidacy of Lyndon Johnson, home man of the district's smallest county, all but unknown in the others, was not taken seriously. Johnson's limited residence in the district was, moreover, proving to be a major handicap in an area in which the word carpetbagger had a particularly distasteful ring. His hometown paper's line, "For the past 8 or 10 years the home folks have seen but little of Mr. Johnson," was quoted out of context by opponents who also noted that, as Avery put it, he has never voted in the district. And his age was turning out to be even more of a handicap than had been expected. He had attempted to minimize this handicap by confusing reporters and voters about it. The press release announcing his candidacy said he will soon be 30 years old. Subsequently, the line adopted was that he was almost 30. In many articles in which a specific age was mentioned, it was 29. Not once during the entire campaign, so far as can be determined, would his actual age, 28, appear in print. But whatever they believed his age to be, his opponents emphasized it. "This Johnson is a young, young man," Stone's campaign manager told a Georgetown audience. "Don't let him take off the baby robe and put on the toga." Any illusions that Johnson may have possessed about the effectiveness of this line of attack were dispelled the first time he shared a platform with Avery at a meeting of the Austin Trades Council. Now, I believe, Avery said, that every boy, by the time he reaches the age of 7, develops a burning desire to be a policeman, a fireman. But before we entrust them with such tasks, we demand that they gain a considerable amount of experience. We just can't picture a youngster with a pop gun chasing bandits. As Johnson sat listening on stage, this sally drew laughter from the audience. But Johnson had men, and he knew how to use men. Divided into teams, they were assigned to towns and told whom to see in each town and what to say. We'd go into a little town, Ernest Morgan recalls. We'd have lists of people to see, and we'd nail up posters. He wanted posters with his picture on them up everywhere. And the first thing we'd do was to go to the local newspaper. He would tell us, "That's the first thing you do, get my picture in the paper. I want it so you can't wipe your ass on a piece of paper that hasn't got my picture on it." Although Governor Allred did not announce the special election until March 5th, Johnson had announced on March 1st that he was running in the election. And the very next morning, cars crowded with Johnson's young men, the young men who had once been the White Stars of San Marcos, were fanning out across the district, racing across the district, speeding away from Giddings after a long day of electioneering. A.J. Hartsky, who in college had been Lyndon Johnson's second candidate for class president, saw roaring toward him on the lonely road to Ledbetter a car that he recognized. It belonged to Bill Deason, Johnson's first candidate for class president. The two men waved as they passed. Neither stopped. There was too much to do. And Johnson had a strategy, and he knew how to use a strategy. The White Stars were told to concentrate on a single, simple point. "When we asked what we should tell people," one recalls, "they told us that the campaign would have many slogans, but that there was only one slogan that mattered. Roosevelt, Roosevelt, Roosevelt. 100% for Roosevelt." That slogan was the entire content of the posters that, on the day following Johnson's announcement, blossomed, unpunctuated but to the point, on trees and fence posts throughout the district. "A vote for Johnson is a vote for Roosevelt's program." It was the sole theme of the calling cards, printed the same day, that were distributed by the tens of thousands. "A vote for Johnson," the cards said, "was a vote for Roosevelt and progress." It was the message emphasized in the letters that began pouring out of his campaign headquarters. "Dear Mr. Carson, Mr. O.E. Crane has suggested that I send you some literature about my campaign for Congress. I stand wholeheartedly with the president on his program, and I invite the people who favor the Roosevelt program to support me. Yours sincerely, Lyndon Johnson." In his initial announcement, Johnson not only stated the theme, but gave it a particular emphasis, one especially appealing in a district grateful to the president for the help he had given it. "Because of the timing of the election," he said, "a vote for Johnson would not only express generalized support of Roosevelt, it would give the president help, help he badly needed, in the fight in which he was currently engaged. The paramount issue of this campaign is whether the president shall be sustained in his program for readjustment of the judicial system," he said. "The voters of the 10th Congressional District, due to the untimely death of Congressman Buchanan, are the first to have a chance to speak on this vital issue, and to have an opportunity to speak with such unanimous voice that there will be no doubt throughout the country as to how our people stand on this question. The way to speak," he said, "was to vote for him. I have always been a supporter of President Roosevelt and am wholeheartedly in favor of his present plan." This emphasis placed two of his opponents at an immediate disadvantage. Polk Shelton was not a man to compromise his principles. "Roosevelt was Jesus Christ in this area," says his brother Emmett, "but Polk was Polk. Nobody could make him say something he didn't believe in." To a reporter's question about his feelings on the Supreme Court fight, the young attorney replied, in a statement taken as a sneer at Wirtz's about-face, "I am opposed to the court reorganization. I was against it before this election, and I'm no hypocrite." Senator Brownlee tried to compromise, but couldn't, since his vote for the legislative resolution condemning the court plan was a matter of record. Furthermore, as Wirtz and Johnson had hoped, the strategy tied in with the editorial stand of Marsh's two daily newspapers, the Austin American and the Austin Statesman. As for Governor James V. Allred, he was personally fond of Johnson and had been impressed by his work as NYA director and by his knowledge of Washington. He felt Johnson could do the most of any of the candidates to get Texas what it was entitled to in Washington, says Ed Clark, the governor's secretary of state, and the man most familiar with Allred's thinking. Nonetheless, the governor had originally decided to remain neutral in the congressional race, in part because he believed that Johnson had no chance to win, and he didn't want to antagonize the next congressman. But Allred was a true liberal, the only true liberal governor elected in Texas in the 20th century, swept into office by the Roosevelt landslide, and he too idolized the president. And Johnson, Clark says, was just such a real rootin' tootin' Roosevelt supporter, Jimmy just couldn't stay out. Publicly, he made no statement, reiterated neutrality, in fact, but privately he allowed Clark to go to work for the man on whom the Secretary of State had decided to buy a ticket. And he put at Johnson's disposal his own campaign manager, veteran Texas political string puller Claude Wild. Allred could not resist one semi-public gesture. As Johnson was leaving his office after a visit, the governor impulsively snatched his big white Stetson off a hat rack and gave it to the young man, who wore it, and let it be known whose it was, at every rally. And Johnson had money, and if, campaigning over unfamiliar terrain, he didn't know how to make the most of it, and he probably did, this wonder boy of politics, Alvin Wirtz knew. Was Johnson unknown to the district's voters? Money could make him known, fast. The printing of posters and calling cards for the typical candidate has to wait on the raising of cash to pay the printer. Thanks to the instant cash provided by Wirtz and Captain Taylor, Johnson's printings were ready the day the campaign began. The only source of political news for most voters was the 25 small weekly newspapers, struggling to survive in sparsely populated areas whose residents were so impoverished that many of them paid their $1.50 for a yearly subscription with a chicken or a cord of wood. Few of their publishers were professional journalists, as prevailing practices and ethics revealed. Short not only on cash, but on news to fill their pages, some of them were willing to print verbatim not only a candidate's advertisements, but articles prepared by the candidate's staff, if the articles were accompanied by money. The individual amounts involved were small, as might be expected when dealing with newspapers in which a merchant could purchase an ad for 50 cents or a dollar. But the payments had to be made to perhaps 20 newspapers. Some publishers refused to go along with this practice, and they had to be made each week. Johnson had the money to make them. The envelopes containing the announcement of his candidacy, an announcement written in the form of a news story, arrived at newspaper offices containing not only his picture, but, although no advertising was being purchased, a check for $10. A covering note from Ray Lee read, "I am enclosing a check for $10, which we want you to credit to our account. We shall want to use some advertising space later in the campaign. Here also is Mr. Johnson's statement announcing for Congress. We hope that you'll be able to use this statement this week." Many papers used the statement in the form in which Johnson wanted it used, and 4 days later Lee sent a follow-up note. "We appreciate your kind and generous treatment. You will hear from us from time to time." The times came fast, and with them promises that they would continue. Johnson himself wrote to one editor, "Here are an ad for your paper this week, a check for $10 for credit against our account, and a news item about one of my speeches. I hope you will be able to handle all three. We are planning to have an ad in your paper each week during the campaign, and would like for you to keep us advised how we stand on your books." Some of the checks grew substantially larger, and publishers were not discouraged from asking for more checks larger still. A typical Lee line was, "If this is not sufficient to cover the amount due, please render us a bill immediately." The payments paid off for the Johnson campaign. A campaign worker reported that, "I called on the Marble Falls Messenger and found that we owed them another $5. He said that he would not add paid advertisement at the end of a news item written by Johnson's staff, because it would carry more weight this way. From beginning to end of the campaign, not only did the amount of Johnson's paid advertising dwarf that of his opponents, so did the amount of news coverage, articles favorable to him written by his aides, that he received. Money could help with the district's political leaders, too. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.